You are listening to Phantha Tracks.
It's time to spin round the rim. This is Desert Planet Discs. Star Wars music in a single file. Here are your hosts, Carl Bayless and Greg Robertson.
Hi, and welcome to another interview special from Desert Planet Discs. This evening, Greg and myself are lucky enough to be speaking to a rock musician who's had worldwide success with bands such as Little Angels, Fastway, Dio's Disciples, and more recently, Wayward Sons, as well as a solo career alongside all of that. Got acting credits, including Gladiator, Sleepy Hollow, Angela's Ashes, Highlander Endgame, and Steven Spielberg's Band of Brothers. More recently, he's also a producer, a broadcaster, a podcaster, and during this current lockdown situation is entertaining fans worldwide with his weekly busker sessions, performing hits from across his own catalogue and cover versions that are being selected. We might find out a bit more about the selection process for those a bit later. So without further ado, we'd like to say a big welcome to Toby Jepson.
Hello, nice to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yes. We've just had a little chat off air. Your career is varied, to say the least.
I like the pause there, Carl. Yeah. Insert whatever word you want in the middle. You know what I mean?
Extremely. So, how did it all start for you?
Goodness me, that is the $64,000 question, isn't it? Well, I mean, it started, like, I suppose, in so many ways, like every other musician, young person who has a desire to essentially emulate your heroes. I mean, I grew up around a lot of fantastic music. My dad was a huge music fan, and we didn't have TV in our house when we were kids. I mean, my mum and dad were, mum was a housewife, dad was a teacher. There was very little money around, you know. It was the sort of tail end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. It was a different world, you know, but the one thing that my mum and dad brought with them from their teenage was their record collection. And so I grew up around amazing, like I say, amazing music. I used to wake up in the morning. I can remember it to this day, you know, waking up as a little boy, you know, 5, 6 years old, even going back that far, and hearing these incredible songs, you know, sort of blasting out through the little house that we lived in. And it sort of became, I suppose, part of my DNA that music was always there. And I didn't even question it, you know, because we weren't looking at a TV screen in the corner of the room. My dad would come home from work and put on, you know, a Cat Stevens album or a, you know, Elton John record or whatever it would be. And we would spend all evening listening to music whilst we as kids played, you know. So it was a fantastic sort of upbringing with regard to that. So that led on to naturally onto the process of me, I suppose, you know, just like every other teenager, sort of finding my own tastes and deciding that really, watching people like Freddie Mercury, who was my key influence, really, from a musical point of view, Queen and Freddie specifically, I just felt like they were aliens. You know, I felt those characters, the rock and roll characters, were aliens. I didn't know where they came from. You know, it seemed like they'd been beamed from somewhere else, and I wanted to find out how it worked. You know, and I suppose that's where it all started, and really it led on from there. But it comes from a place of passion. It's not contrived. I've never had a plan. I don't think plans are very interesting. I much prefer to follow the trail and the emotional arc of my life, and I've always done that, and for good and bad. But I think really then becomes an authentic life, if you like, because that's the way it is. I'm inspired by things that I'm inspired by. The passion of it all is more important to me than anything else, and so I've just followed that, you know. And every band I've been in, you know, every band I've been in has been driven by that desire to do something creative and artistic with that band, or as a solo artist, or when I'm co-writing with other people. It's not driven by wanting to make money, and maybe therein lies the rub, because I've never been a wealthy man, certainly from a financial point of view. But in terms of like the art and the sort of the belief and the joy and involvement of working in the art world, specifically in the music business, I couldn't be richer.
Fantastic. And you mentioned Queen there, and reading of past interviews you've done, you mentioned Queen and Star Wars as being two of the main influences in getting into music and performing. Tell us about your earliest Star Wars memory.
Oh, goodness me. Fantastic. I mean, it was actually the first movie I was allowed to go and see on my own. 1977, I was 10 years old. And my mum and dad were, you know, like I say, they were probably you could regard them as the first generation of sort of proper teenagers. You know, what I mean by that is teenagers that came out of the 60s, 50s, you know, post-war 60s, you know. And so they were progressive. They were very into art of all forms. And so when I started getting into film, which I did, I mean, the first movie I really got into was The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, which was Clint Eastwood classic spaghetti western. I remember that was my eureka moment, actually. But I can remember around the same time that Star Wars was emerging and that whole world started to explode, it was around a similar time that Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out, which I think was a year or so after, or even probably the same year, if I remember correctly. And so I just fell head over heels in love with science fiction and the idea of visiting these worlds. And I think the thing that got me about Star Wars was there was a buzz in the world, across the whole of the globe, if you remember it. You know, I can remember the conversations on radio in the newspapers were all about this phenomena, you know, and no one had ever experienced anything quite like it. It literally was the first blockbuster. So when it arrived in Scarborough, it was the same. I can remember that I queued up with my friend. I went with a guy who was a friend of the family, who was several years older than me, because I was only 10 and I think he was like 18 or something. And we queued up, and it's the only time in Scarborough I can remember a queue that was five or six times around the cinema, if you know what I mean. It literally, it snaked all the way back around the cinema. And at the time, the main cinema in Scarborough was where the Stephen Joseph Theatre in the Round is now, which was an old Odeon. But it was one of the biggest Odeons outside of the West End, because Scarborough was a really successful seaside town. And so they built an enormous cinema. And in fact, they built one on the foreshore called the Futurist Theatre, which had the second biggest screen in the whole of the UK at the time, believe it or not. And also the one in the Odeon in the middle of town also had an enormous screen. And I can remember sort of going into this darkened room. And I'd only been to the cinema two or three times before with my mum and dad, because I was only little, remember, you know, and movies weren't like they are now. They weren't so readily available. It was quite an sort of an expedition to go out and see a film, you know. So we'd seen Disney films and all the rest of it. But this was the film I really wanted to see on my own. And I remember insisting that I'd go with my friend, not with my mum and dad, you know. So we queued up. We literally queued up. Must have been for an hour. And we got into this room. And I can remember the feeling of when the scroll started at the front. And I can still remember, it puts on the hairs on the back of my neck up now as I'm talking about it. Sat in the middle of that theatre, absolutely packed with rapt anticipation. You could feel the energy in the air. Something was happening. Something new was occurring here. Something people had never seen before. And when that initial scroll happened, and then the ship comes over the top of the image, of the screen, you know, that very, very famous first shot with the fighters coming underneath and all the rest of it, with the planet in the distance. I literally thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was like entering an entirely different world. And from that moment on, I don't think I've ever been the same, because it was imagination. It was the fulfilling of an imaginative trail that I feel that a lot of us have in our hearts. But until you have someone as genius as, you know, as George, to be able to put that on the screen and create something so new. Because, I mean, the thing that gets me about Star Wars, and I always come back to this, and I've got all the books, I've got the ILM books, I've seen all the documentaries, is that they created it from the ground up, didn't they? Everything was made in practical effects. They had to create it. Nothing had ever been done like it before. And they managed to pull it off. It wasn't something that was hokey. It was a boy's own adventure story. Well, I mean, I think that's terribly sexist, but because I think just as many girls enjoyed it. But you know what I mean? It was that kind of old school, Buck Rogers, edge of your seat, incredible storytelling, told in good old traditional terms of good versus evil and the overcoming of those things. And I think it encapsulated an energy and a feeling and a desire and I think really an emotion, a set of emotions that, you know, we all feel, especially when you're young. I think that's the key for me, is I was 10, you know. So to see all these things manifest on a screen, and to deliver this promise, this sense of beauty, this sense of overwhelming hope was something that has never, ever left me. And every time I watch that film, and I watch it regularly, specifically A New Hope, it brings that feeling back, and I remember why I still love it, and I remember where that feeling of hope came from, and I've never lost it. And so, you know, I thank George for that.
You love George. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for George 40 years later.
Well, exactly.
Talking about it.
Hi, this is Vanessa Marshall, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
Now, watching the Busker sessions, which has been fantastic last few weeks now, keeping us sane, I think, in all this madness in the world, we've seen some of your Star Wars merchandise on display, your AT-AT, your Darth Vader helmet. Are you a collector yourself? Do you have a large collection of Star Wars memorabilia?
Not huge, but I have some choice pieces. I've got the the helmet, I've got the AT-AT, and I've got various other bits and pieces, you know. I've got some old vintage posters up in the loft, which I haven't yet had a chance to properly frame. So when I moved from my house in Scarborough, and I now live in Somerset, I moved to a smaller house. I haven't got as much wall space. So it's not something I've managed to get around to yet. But I have a small amount of stuff. And I've got all the movies, and I've got the various versions of them. And the only thing I kick myself about is that years ago, when I first started collecting VHS movies, you know, and I started doing that quite young, really. I think when they first started coming out and they were available for sale, I bought all of the VHS movies, but before they did the adaptations and they did the reinvent, you know, they did the polishes.
Yeah.
So I had the original New Hope on VHS, where you can see the guy in the background with his tape, his tape on, you know, I think one of the prop guys in the back in Millennium Falcon. And I bloody gave all those away. I gave them all to buy DVDs like an idiot, you know. So that's my only regret, that I didn't keep them, because actually I don't think you can even get those versions anymore. Well, I certainly haven't seen those versions, but not a huge collection, but it, you know what, not without wanting to sound too stupid, it kind of lives in me really more than anything else, you know.
This is the memories that you get from Star Wars is enough for, you know, it's you know, lives with you forever. Is there one particular piece of merchandise or a prop you wish you owned?
Oh, goodness me. Well, you know what? It's weird. When I was working in the film business, this is a slight aside, but this does tie in quite nicely. When I was working on Sleepy Hollow, we were working at Leavesden Studios, where they were making the first of the prequels. And I spent about two, three weeks there, and I had a small role in that film, which ended up on the cutting room floor, which was annoying. But anyway, I was kind of wandering around the set at one point, and I went into what I didn't know at the time was a kind of forbidden zone. And it was where they were keeping a lot of the Star Wars props. And I just became aware of the fact that there was all this stuff. I thought, hang on, there was all these cages, you know, these huge steel cages with all this stuff behind it. And there was like a sort of land speeder. There was all these kind of odd stuff. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm looking at all the Star Wars props for the new, because nobody knew what it was going to be called at the time. They were still shooting it, I think. And I could see this huge sort of silver thing at the end of the corridor. And I walked towards it and I thought, that looks like a huge door, like a sort of big prop. But as I got closer, I realized what it was a load of Flymos, literally Flymos, screwed to this huge frame and sprayed silver. Nice. And that's how they made it look. They'd taken the same sort of principle, that they'd taken sort of, you know, everyday items and created these props out of them rather than having to sort of create them themselves. So I thought that was brilliant, you know, like this utilizing that. So I think that door would have been too big for me to bring home, but I guess really, I think every Star Wars fan would love to have an original lightsaber, wouldn't they? From the original film. I mean, that would be something else, wouldn't it?
So, has Star Wars influenced your songwriting or your career in any way?
I think really just, you know, harking back to the first question, really. I think great storytelling and great performance runs through the strata of every area of entertainment. You know, you can't escape the aspect of storytelling in any, whether it's songwriting, whether it's painting a picture, whether it's making a movie, whether it's writing a novel, whether it's telling your own story. That is inherently at the center of everything that artistic people do, really, is the storytelling aspect. And then being able to deliver that story in an impassioned, connective, authentic manner. That's been my driving force. And I definitely think becoming a movie fan, and specifically loving the Star Wars films, specifically the first three, obviously, I think has influenced me enormously in a way that perhaps I'm probably unaware. And I think it is to do with the hope. I always come back to that. I always come back to the fact that that film filled me with hope, filled me with a sense of awe and expectation and anything's possible. But more than anything else, I think it's the beauty of the storytelling, the sort of erudite fashion that they approach that whole story that has compelled me. And I think, yes, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think the drama of it, I mean, you know, I think the sort of the score, you know, Williams' score and everything was so amazing. And we'd never seen anything or heard anything like that with that kind of film, that without a doubt, that's influenced me as a composer. I mean, I'm actually, me and Dave Kemp, who you probably know, is a saxophone player and plays keyboards for me in Wayward Sons. We've been long-term collaborators, and we're currently working on a fantasy kids film at the moment. And we're constantly using John Williams as a point of reference, you know, because there's no one greater. There's no greater composer, you know. And so I think in many, many ways, it's multifaceted as the influence, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were going to ask, what's your favourite Star Wars film and what's your favourite character? But I'm guessing the film's going to be New Hope.
It absolutely is New Hope. It is, I find it hard to get beyond. I know a lot of people think Empire is the better sequel, and I think it is a fantastic sequel. It's probably one of the greatest sequels of all time. You know, I would absolutely not disagree with that. And I think it stands up there as an incredible step forward. I think Kershner did an amazing job on that. And I think that the expansion of the storytelling and all the rest of it and the darkening of the tone was wonderful. But I still go back to New Hope because I just think it's like everyone sort of says, you know, with anything that's original, it's like, it really irritates me when people say, oh, that cover version that so-and-so has done so much better than the original. And I think, how can it be?
Yeah.
By very definition, it can't be, because the original's the reason. You know, it's crazy to me. So I look at, and I put in the concept that they got to that place in the first place.
Yeah.
How they were able to write that, how they were able to pull that off. Lucas's breadth of vision and his focus is breathtaking. There is not another example, I don't think, in the modern art world that equals it, apart from maybe Stephen King as an author. You know, it's extraordinary what he managed to do with that film. And so, yes, I categorically, hands down, there are moments in that film that will never be beaten for sense of occasion, sense of drama, sense of achievement, really. And without a doubt, my favourite character is Han Solo, without a doubt.
As we've already touched on, you've done a fair bit of acting yourself, and we understand you're keen to write and direct your own film at some point. You've already mentioned you're working on a kids' fantasy film. So if Lucasfilm come knocking and say, Toby, we'd like you to write and direct a Star Wars standalone film.
Okay.
What era would you kind of go? Would you go back to that New Hope era? Or would you go way outside, you know? What sort of thing would you like to do?
Wow, now that's a massive question.
Yes.
Massive question. So here's my thing, right? Here's my thing. A lot of people would disagree with this, I'm sure. But a massive part of the reason why a lot of the other films, in my opinion, haven't worked as well is because they missed the point. There's so much about A New Hope which is seated in very simplistic storytelling that's about character development and character arcs which are not only connective but have a sense of deep relationship, and I think that's been sadly missing in a lot of the sequels myself. And it seems to me a very, very simple thing is that Lucas, even though a lot of people deride his deride his dialogue, which I can kind of agree with to a certain degree, I do think what he did get right was the relationship building, that incredible combination of the innocence and the rogue between Skywalker and Han Solo, the kind of strange love interest of Leia and what that meant and how that played out, but it had a deep sense of innocence about it. There was nothing that was, you know, that had anything suspect about that at all. It was very kind and gentle in its approach, actually, and that's why it worked for me. It gave the hero heft, because the hero was an innocent. and everyone else around it was a kind of, you know, it was a foil for that. And it allowed the relationships to develop very gently, very easily, and very believably. That's the other thing. The connective tissue between the viewer and the protagonist on the screen is really, really strong, I think. Because you can believe in it. You actually have connection to it. You can relate to it. And I think me as a young boy, seeing, you know, Luke Skywalker's developing story arc, and not that I knew that's what it was. I thought it was all real, you know. But I could believe I could be Luke Skywalker. Do you know what I mean? And I really wanted to be Han Solo, but I knew that really I was probably just Luke Skywalker. You know? So it was a kind of innocence thing for me, and I think that's been lacking a lot. And I think that's where this kind of sitting around a table and deciding things by committee was never going to work, because actually it came out the brain of one very, very smart man who had the whole story in his head and knew that really that 1950s, because here's the rub, that 1950s approach to cliffhanger kids serials, you know, was where he got it from. It was that sense of innocence from a period that was very, very innocent, post-war and all, and he understood that because he grew up with that. And that's where I would go. I'd go back to that. I'd go back to trying to examine the story from a kind of more simplistic point of view and allow the backdrop to be the backdrop of what it is, you know, all the technology and the kind of drama of that, but really center it all on the relationships.
Cool.
I really do waffle, don't I? I know.
Now, the second gig I ever went to was Little Angels at the Music Hall in Aberdeen, and you could feel the energy and the passion and the love for music coming off a stage. And it's one of the main reasons I sing today in my spare time, and have done for the last, oh God, 30 years or whatever. So thank you very much for that.
Well, listen, that's a massive compliment. And like I said to you, you know, earlier on, I think the thing is about music and art, and, you know, perhaps why we all love the Star Wars movies so much, is that it is about the passion, I think. I think it's deeply seated in that sort of passionate belief in an idea. And you can't hide that, you know, and you shouldn't do.
No, absolutely.
I'm Anthony Daniels, and you are listening to Fanfare Tracks. Well done.
So with that in mind, I wanted to ask, what was your, obviously you mentioned some of your influences earlier on, in terms of your parents at home with the record players. What influenced you to become a singer-songwriter, and who was your kind of, I guess, your performance, who did you look at for performance-wise for your just stagecraft or...
Well, I mean, I think I said earlier on, I mean, the key guy for me really is Freddie Mercury. I think Freddie's the gold standard. There's very few people that ever come anywhere near close to him in so many ways. I think his natural abilities to communicate through not just his writing, but his aura. It's like my mum, God bless her soul, you know, she's passed now, but she always used to say that there was very few people on the planet that were able to connect the whole planet, and she always used to say that Elvis Presley was one of them, that he sort of bestrode the globe like a colossi, you know, was able to sort of reach so many people on so many levels. And I think Freddie Mercury was the same for me in that regard. I think there's so much about the guy, the humanity of the man, you know, the kind of, it wasn't just his writing, it was his whole presence that made you feel connected and you feel like you knew him, you know. And so I think it's very, very hard to beat Freddie. The next guy on my list really, you know, is David Bowie. Bowie, as far as I'm concerned, is up there with Fred and one of the greatest writer performers of all time, if certainly in my top three. But again, it's almost like comparing apples with oranges in lots of ways, because there are so many influences I have, you know, John Lennon, the Beatles, a lot of hard rock, a lot of punk. You know, when I was a kid, I grew up in a house when I was a teenager, my eldest sister was heavily into punk rock, and as a result of that, I became heavily influenced by punk rock. So I would walk out my bedroom having played the latest Rainbow record or the latest Black Sabbath album, and she'd be playing the latest Clash album, and I would love that just as much, you know. So, and I've never really put a brakes on that. I've never really sort of tried to departmentalize things. I just think it's either good or it's bad. And I think that's kind of it for me. It's hard to put a finger on exactly a kind of collection of people, but I would say, you know, a push, it's definitely Freddie and David Bowie that are the two key people in my sort of world, if you like.
Fantastic.
You mentioned that in your Sleepy Hollow filming that you were at Leavesden. Did you meet any of the actors at the time?
What in Sleepy Hollow?
No, the Star Wars actors.
Oh, no. It was, well, I got completely bollocked by the first assistant director for wandering into that area for a start anyway. So, No, I mean, the only thing I will say is I did spend every morning in the makeup chair, sat next to Christopher Lee. He was literally sat in the same. We had a conversation for about an hour and a half every morning, because the weird thing was I'd only been involved in the film business for a short space of time, but I'd joined a couple of essentially just extras agencies. But the thing about the extras world, this is where everybody starts really, unless you've had training and you've gone through that sort of world, is that they're overwhelmed by people that just want to go and eat donuts and stand around on a film set and don't actually want to work hard. So if you put a little bit of extra time in and you make a few friends, they tend to call you a bit more. So because that's the way I am, and I'm a massive cinephile and I love filmmaking and all the rest of it. To be on a film set in any shape or form was a massive thing for me. It was a huge privilege, you know. And so I made every effort to make sure I befriended everybody. And so I used to get quite a few calls out of the blue. And this one particular call from my agency was, look, we've got you a small part in the new Tim Burton movie. Do you fancy it? And of course, you know, when I picked myself up from the floor and picked the phone back up again, I said, of course, what time do you want me there? So I had to be there at sort of, I think it was like 6 a.m. or something, because it's always the same way in a film set. So I turned up to I turned up to Leavesden, and Leavesden's an old aerodrome. It's the film business does this brilliantly well. They basically co-opt old aerodromes. It was the same with Band of Brothers. That was the Hatfield aerodrome, which developed the Comet aeroplane jet. And they took that over and turned it into a movie studio, essentially. Leavesden's the same. It's just essentially a bunch of, you know, aircraft hangars that they turned into sound stages. So I turned up to this old place and it was just knackered. There was all these discarded old sort of, you know, rooms and buildings and old steel staircases that were all rusted through. I thought, well, where the hell is this place? You know, this can't be a film studio. Surely not, you know. So I kind of wandered down and found the sort of way into this, asked this person for directions, and I walked up these stairs. Oh, he's through there. Go through there. So I walked through these steps, and as I got to the sort of midway up this staircase, this enormous chap in full leathers was stood at the top of the stairs, fringe leather jacket, leather jeans, big biker boots, white scarf wrapped around his head. I realised within about 30 nanoseconds that it was Christopher Lee. So I'm stood there looking at him like, you know, and he went, ugh. Are you looking for the makeup area? And I said, yes, I am. He goes, oh, so am I. Do you know where it is? And I said, oh, I don't know. Shall we go and have a look? So we spent about 10 minutes trying to find us, eventually found our way in. And we just got on great. You know, he sat in his makeup bit, having his, because he was playing the judge, if you remember, that he played a judge in Sleepy Hollow. Yeah. And I was in that same scene. And so I was having this, it was the most ridiculous irony. I just had all my hair cut off. I was short haired at the time. And they put a great big ginger wig on me, which was really random. So I had to go through hair and makeup every morning for about 2 weeks with Christopher Lee sat in the chair next to me. It was talking about, and he was a massive heavy metal fan. That was the most amazing thing. He talked endlessly about metal, but an incredibly smart man. I mean, you know, just incredibly intelligent. And he talked a lot about the war, because I think he'd been involved in espionage in the war, and he talked a bit about that, and he talked about the films, and I kept asking him question after question, and he was so generous, you know, such a generous person. And it was a real amazing experience. So I indirectly met somebody from
Well, if you're going to meet somebody indirectly, Christopher Lee's probably up there.
It was amazing. It was an amazing experience, you know, and one that will live with me to my dying day, without a doubt.
Have you listened to Christopher Lee's heavy metal albums? He did a couple of metal albums.
I tried.
Yeah.
I listened to one where he was doing this kind of like monologue over the top of this kind of death metal of what I don't know what the hell it was.
Oh, I can't think what it's called now.
Do we not were planning to pick him on the Christmas episode, weren't we, at one point? Because he did a cover of a Drummer Boy or something.
Yes. We're pushing that out to next Christmas, I think.
Yeah. And it wasn't his finest moment, I've got to say. But he's got so many, it's hard to criticise.
No, you can't criticise a man that's had that big a career in movies.
Exactly.
As well as performing, you're also a very successful producer. In fact, you recorded my pals in She Burns Red at the tail end of last year.
Oh, brilliant band. Yeah, love them. Great guys. So,
something you were always keen to do when you joined the industry?
No, not at all. I couldn't have been less interested. I had a passing interest in studios when the Little Angels were a band, you know, when we were young kids. mainly because I didn't know how any of it worked, and I just thought it was sort of like entering the Starship Enterprise or something. It was always, you know, flashing lights and bits of equipment, and I used to ask basic questions, and I always used to like being in the environment, don't get me wrong. I used to think it was incredible, but because it seemed so technical and so difficult, and at the time, you've got to remember, when Little Angels were recording seriously, when we started making our proper albums, our studio albums, we were working in 5-star top of the range studios, which were populated by technicians. It's not like it is today, where it's all on a computer. It was mainframe desks, SSL boards, you know, outboard equipment, massive control rooms. You know, there'd be a tape operator, there'd be a guy that brought, you know, brought the tea, there'd be another guy that set the machine up, there'd be a second engineer, there'd be a producer, second producer. It was just like ridiculous. So there'd be 6 or 7 people quite a lot of the time in the room that were doing technical jobs. And so I never thought to ask, because it just seemed so impossible. You know, it seemed like a kind of proper skill, you know. So when I got approached to, well, I mean, I guess really the first time I self-produced was when I made the Ignorance is Bliss record, which I'm just about to re-release, actually, because it's the same thing as anything else, is that necessity is the mother of invention, isn't it? If you're presented with a situation where you have to make something happen, you better make sure you make it happen. And so I was kind of thrown into the situation where I couldn't afford to go in a studio to record it. And my publisher at the time, who was Sony, they gave me some money to buy. They said, look, go and buy some equipment and record it at home. And I sort of like took a deep breath and went, oh, okay, I'll do that then. Not having a single clue how to do it. So it was a baptism by fire. So I did that and enjoyed it. And then years and years and years later, when I was sort of working on my own EPs and things like that, you know, the Refresh EP, and I was coming back and starting to record again and to tour again, I was far more equipped to deal with the nuances of making records in a studio. And it grew and grew and grew from there. And eventually I got asked to work with a band called Virgin Marys, which were a band from Macclesfield, who were the first band I properly produced as a producer. And from there on, I basically haven't stopped working as a producer. I mean, these days I'm a bit more choosy. I choose things that I want to work on. And of course, the climate has changed. Not everyone can afford somebody like me to produce a record, because, you know, it's quite easy to make records at home these days, you know. Albeit I'd always argue not as good as making it in the studio with a producer. But there you go, you know. But no, I enjoy it. It's not something I expected to do, put it that way.
Hello, I'm Warwick Davis, and you're listening to Fanthatrax.
Excellent, cheers.
Cool. You mentioned earlier a little bit about the sequel films. Have you sort of seen all the Disney era output and any of the TV stuff as well? Have you seen?
I've seen The Mandalorian, which I really enjoyed. I thought the whole concept of The Mandalorian was brilliant. I thought the first 3 episodes were amazing. Then it went a little bit Buck Rogers for me, but then it did pull it back towards the end. And I think it's a great idea. I think it's, you know, I think they kind of, in many, many ways, regained a lot of the stuff that, for me, they'd lost in the films. I'll be honest, I didn't like the last movie of this last sequence of 3. I found it convoluted and completely the polar opposite of what I love about Star Wars and the original trilogy. That's my personal view. I can understand how they needed to tie a lot of the strands together, but, you know, conjuring spaceships out of the planet's surface. didn't wash with me, and I felt there was the coils of the plot were laying on the floor and coiling up rather a lot of, you know, throughout the whole of that movie, as much as it has some great moments, you know. But I can understand why. I think the biggest, do you know what the biggest mistake for a lot of these things is with I think the modern film business is that it's entirely driven by money these days. Even though it always was to a certain degree, I think there was a far more open-minded view, certainly sort of at the tail end of the 70s, or actually all the way through the 70s. I mean, I'm a massive 70s movies fan in general, because that was the golden era of modern filmmaking in lots of ways. Because the people at the helm that were producing these films and the studio executives came from an earlier period where they were in the studio system, and the studio system changed and gave them a greater reign and allowed them to be more artistic. So there was a brilliant, beautiful balance between the need to spend the right amount of money on making a film and it to be commercially successful. But they were very, very interested back then, far more in the art. And I think that's how Star Wars was able to be made, because, you know, even though that film got turned down at every studio, it took one very, very bright executive to stand up and go, actually, I can see this. I can see that this could be something really important, you know. And I just don't think that happens anymore. I think it's entirely generated by the bottom line. And why? It's the same as the music business. The people that are running this business, the film business, and the people that are running the music business are, by and large, people that are not artistic. It's lawyers and accountants. And so they look at it from that perspective. And the problem with that approach is that it becomes decision-making by committee. It's not they're not using their heart and their balls to make decisions. And so I think that's where it's fallen apart in lots of ways. That's what's been so interesting about The Mandalorian, because a lot of the most fantastic, I think, output, artistically visual output at the moment is actually through Netflix and through Amazon and through probably Disney Prime and these sort of self, you know, subscription models, is that actually, because it's not under the same, you know, demands commercially, because they've got millions of people subscribing, they can have a greater freer reign. I mean, that's been the revolution, hasn't it, in the Netflix era, really? Yeah. And so I think that's where The Mandalorian does work, because all of a sudden, they can go, actually, we can take the brakes off, we can talk about this properly, we can actually apply it to how a real Star Wars fan perhaps would enjoy this, rather than it being commercially driven to get as many 12-year-olds into the cinema as possible. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So that's been my struggle with it. I can't say that I haven't enjoyed the movies, because I've seen every one of them, and I think they all bring something, but it's just not as complete for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think there's parallels between sort of Star Wars and music, where, you know, people have got a stronger attachment to what they consider to be like their era, you know? So same as you would with like a band, you know. You obviously remember fondly sort of growing up with Queen.
Yeah.
Greg and I have got the same thing with sort of Little Angels, and you, although you go off and explore other things that are linked to that. So, you know, I got into Queen partly through you guys constantly going, yeah, Queen or Ace. So I go, okay, I'll try and listen to them then. And, yeah. You know, so that sort of thing. Do you think there are parallels there?
I of course there are. I mean, I think it would be an untruth if I didn't say that was true. I think we all live in our own era, don't we? We react to the first things that tend to inspire you, the things that live with you forever. You know, I mean, I think that's true. But I think also, conversely, I think there is a sense of that if the story or the song is strong enough, it's nothing to do with the era. I mean, part of my world as a creative person and a music business person is I do consultations for young bands, and I talk to bands about making records, you know, and trying to survive in this business. And I'll guarantee you guys, 99.9% of the reason why bands don't succeed is because they simply aren't strong enough writers. It doesn't matter what great guitar you've got and what amplifier you own and how, you know, and what clothes you wear. It's to do with a narrative. It's to do with understanding what storytelling is. It's to do with how you deliver that idea. It's to do with having a vision. It's to do with being unique. And I think that goes through the whole strata of the art world. The biggest problem we have now is that the art world is essentially, it's a quagmire. You know, it's white noise. You know, there's so much music. There are so many, there are so many small independent films being made. There's so much stuff, but not much of it's very good. But the trouble is with the technology is the technology allows for the fact that music can, even if it's not fantastic and there's not a great song, it can still sound okay, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So part of the problem is the technology. I think we're back in the day when I was making records in serious studios with Little Angels, it was a serious skill to understand how to make a record. Being a producer was multifaceted. You used to have to know how all the equipment worked. It was all highly technical. It was a skill that you learned over many, many years. These days, if you get into Pro Tools as a producer, you can buy plugins that have presets you don't even have to think about. So therein lies the problem for me. It's not to do with the era, it's to do with the quality of the art. And I think the focus is not on the art anymore. The focus is on the commercial aspects and on the marketing aspects. And I think if everyone got back to asking themselves the question, is this good enough? Am I adding anything to the art world with this? And if they literally can't look at themselves in the face, looking themselves in the mirror and go, I actually think it is, then you probably haven't got anything, if you know what I mean. It's that, and I think that is the problem, is that we are saturated with art these days, and a lot of it isn't very good.
Yeah.
Amen to that.
In terms of your plans for the future, obviously the current climate aside, what have you got planned in terms of just now whilst we've got the social distancing restrictions in place?
Yeah.
And what's the plans for after that lockdown's kind of passed? Is there going to be a Toby and the Whole Truth tour possibly for the anniversary of the record, or an acoustic tour, or?
Well, all of the above. How long have you got, lads? well, I mean, one great positive thing that's come out of this situation is I've had plenty of time to think. You know, even though I'm very very busy, you know, I try to adapt. I think I've been pretty. All through my life, I've tried my hardest to adapt to situations. I'm not one, even though we've talked about the past being important, I'm actually pretty progressive as a person. I don't like to sit on my laurels. I like to test myself. I like to try do different things. I don't like to become bored of what I'm doing. You know, I like to try and push the envelope in my own way as much as possible, hence the multi-stranded sort of life that I lead. And so this situation that we're in now has allowed me to think about that. Even though, like I say, I've gone onto the internet and I've started to sort of develop myself as a kind of web-based artist in many, many ways. That is definitely part of my future. I think that's part of a lot of musicians' future, because I think the big thing about the COVID-19 pandemic is that it's not going away quickly, irrespective of what we do in terms of social distancing being relaxed and all the rest of it, and the lockdown being relaxed. You know, you only have to look at history. Look back to the Spanish flu. Look back to historical bases of the plague periods and all the rest of it that Europe went through 300, 400 years ago. Some of those situations lasted for 100 years. Black Death, you know, and I know it's entirely different now, but the bubonic plague, etc., is a good example, lasted for well over 100 years, if not longer, you know, in terms of like being able to deal with it for all the obvious reasons. But the reality is that these things are natural. When they occur for long periods of time. And so I think we're going to see a very changed situation. And so I'm preparing myself for that in lots and lots of ways. So that to me is about getting back to the roots, getting back to the writing. It's getting back to understanding myself and trying to figure out whether my art and the art that I'm doing has got some value, and trying to, you know, bring that art into some sort of fruition. So the key things I'm doing is, yes, I will be doing some more solo stuff. I'm probably pushing that forward. Developing myself as a web-based artist, definitely some acoustic stuff without a doubt, because I've really enjoyed doing that again, and I kind of lost touch with that a little bit. A new Wayward Sons record, which we're currently working on at the moment. We've got 12 songs in the can, which we're developing, so that's ongoing. But the big one for me really is the films. I'm writing a TV series at the moment with a production company at the moment, which is a music business-based murder drama. And I'm also writing a historical fantasy drama, which is based in slave trade, which is those two things I'm developing as creative things. And I'm also writing my autobiography as well, which is proving to be quite a challenge. So for me, it's lots of things. And I tend to follow my heart. I tend to follow which takes on the biggest sort of challenge at the time. And certainly in terms of the filmmaking, that's a big part of my future. I do want to direct, and if this TV series, I'm just writing the pilot at the moment, and I think we're going to get it made. And if the pilot gets made and it goes where we want it to go, then the likelihood is I'll write the whole thing and probably direct an episode or two. That's the plan.
Excellent. Well, sign us up for those. We'll be watching. We're waiting for those to come out for sure.
Definitely. Definitely. So
cool, guys.
That about brings us to the end of our interview this evening. I'd like to say massive thank you again to Toby for taking some time out of his extremely busy schedule to speak to us. And where can people get hold of you on the web, social media and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I've rekindled my love of websites, actually. And because I think, you know, it's all well and good being on Facebook and all the rest of it. I think you need a hub. You need a place where everyone can go and it's all captured and it's part. That's where your world is. So I've got tobyjeffersonofficial.com, which is my hub, my website. That's where essentially you can reach me from, you know, the Facebook stuff, my Twitter, my Instagram. I'm starting a Patreon subscription service as well, which is going to be for the deep layers, for super fans who want to get involved in listening to my demos, my phone demos and the archive. And I'm going to be doing some exclusive content for that area of things. We're just literally putting that together at the moment. But yeah, I mean, the Thursday nights have been great fun. Thursday nights through my Facebook feed, my official Facebook feed is a great fun, and I'm going to continue those into the near future. So Yeah, I mean, it's I'm pretty visible, put it that way. So if you want to find me, it's not too difficult.
Brilliant. So thank you again, Toby. Look forward to seeing all the plethora of things that are coming out.
An absolute pleasure to be interviewed, and I much appreciate your time. Thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you. Very much. Thanks for listening to Desert Planet Discs. If you want to stay part of the action and up to date on all the latest Star Wars news, check out the Fantatrax app via the App Store on your mobile device.
You can contact us via email at radio@fantatrax.com. Comment, like and share on any of our social media feeds at Fantatrax, and be sure to subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice.
Don't forget to head to fantatrax.com/radio, home of Fantatrax Radio, and follow us on our social media feeds at Fantatrax, and bookmark fantatrax.com for all the latest in Star Wars news.
Coming up next on Fantatrax Radio, it's Making Tracks.